This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Well, thank you, Damon, and thank everybody else for being kind enough to come and listen to me talk. The plan is that I'll talk for half an hour, and that you will then talk for half an hour with occasional interruptions from me as the answers to your questions. Now, I'm going to try and press something and see if anything happens. Going back one. There we are. I've written a book, and the book is about the follies of economics as it's generally promulgated today. My wife, Jilly, to whom the book is dedicated, calls it a smug bucket book. She explains it as saying, I'm right and everybody else is wrong. And that is a bit too near the truth to be comfortable. But I hope to convince you that at least I'm not wrong on all points. And the things I'm going to try and explain to you, or convince you of, are firstly that it was poor economic theory, that caused the financial crisis, quite centrally. Secondly, that it is now thwarting a sustainable recovery, and it's raising the risks of another crisis. To understand this, you have to understand the basis for the economic theory, which was basically that which was held by the central bankers of the world prior to the crash. This is the well-known neoclassical consensus or synthesis. Now, in this theory, there is no place for debt, asset prices, or even a financial sector at all. Now, that may not be wrong. People who look at the solar system and make predictions about it ignore the existence of man. It really makes no difference, and they are quite right. In a couple hundred thousand years, they may be wrong. We may start to have a significant influence on the movement and the planets, but we don't at the moment. So there's no necessity for the fact that there is an obvious lacuna in the theory for the theory to be wrong. But unfortunately, when those who did point out that there was a lacuna in the theory and that this was going to cause trouble proved to be correct, you would hope that those who obstinately stuck to their views before would have started to modify them. Financial crises, in my view, are caused by excessive debt and triggered by large falls in asset prices. And you can have the examples of the US in 1929, Japan in 1990, or the world in 2008. Unfortunately, three examples are not a great deal for proving something statistically. So I'm holding that as a probable rather than a readily testable hypothesis. Inadequate theory has bad consequences. It is not correct to say that nobody warned of the coming crash. In my book, I refer to Cassandra as the model of a good analyst. She was a good analyst because she was always right. For example, she predicted the fall of Troy. She gave no time frame for her predictions, and she was never believed. These are almost invariably the high qualities of a really good analyst, sadly. The basis of this will go back not so much to Hayek as to Minsky. A great deal of debt is borrowed against assets. When asset prices fall, lenders worry, and so do borrowers. Lenders worry they're not going to get repaid, and borrowers who are over the top worry about being able to borrow in the future. The result of that is you get plans to invest and consumption falling, plans to save rising, and you have, and here I'm a Keynesian, I believe this is a very good explanation, you get an ex-ante saving surplus. The bigger the debts and the larger the price falls, the larger the ex-ante saving surplus is likely to be. To avoid this falling into recession, Keynes correctly said, a fiscal deficit is essential. Now, we then start to look at beyond the immediate Keynesian approach to look at what lies behind this. The first thing to note is that excess savings are overwhelmingly found in the business sector. See this in the US. That's a chart which shows fiscal deficits and the business surplus. That's the same one for the UK, and that's the same one for Japan. They're not directly causal. They're identities. Identities actually are often a lot more useful than forecasts in economics. And the correlation coefficients vary from 0.7 to 0.83 for those three countries. And the lower ones only because we have rather limited data. I've put all the data we have available. For example, we've only got data of the UK since 1987. This time, the key mistake that's being made is that the current surplus, particularly in the corporate sector, is cyclical. It's structural. Followers who await a recovery in the animal spirits of entrepreneurs, the great words of Keynes, leading to escape velocity, a new phrase much found, are going to be disappointed. The evidence shows quite clearly that this assumption is without merit. In all three countries, Japan, the US, and the UK, the current savings surpluses in the corporate sector are structural rather than cyclical. Having caused the crisis, bad economics is now thwarting a recovery. As the savings surpluses are structural, we can't cure them by simply pushing on demand. We've got to tackle the underlying causes of the excesses that exist. And these excesses exist in two of these countries, and even one to some extent, in the external account and in the corporate sector. Even today, in all three countries, the household savings surplus is extremely low. Now, the cause of these problems is different in different countries. In Japan, the surplus is caused by excess depreciation allowances. In the UK and the US, what we had is a change in the way managements are paid. When you change the way people are paid, you change their incentives, and when you change their incentives, you change their behavior. And people who work on elegant models which contain no change in behavior are not going to notice this. We have here the impact of the bonus culture. There is a very good paper on this showing how dramatically payments have changed in America, and I don't see the thing being very different in the UK. The paper is by Fridman and Genta, and it was published in 2010, so the most recent data is 2008, and what they show is a dramatic fall in the proportion of total remuneration which comes from basic salary and an increase in the amount that comes from bonuses and options and other things of that sort. It is obvious, surely, that if you change people's incentive, you're going to change their behavior. And to ignore this seems to me to be very, very foolish. What has happened is the interests of management have increasingly diverged from those of the company and its shareholders. This is quite funny, really. A lot of the driving for the change in corporate remuneration comes from Harvard Business School and other business schools, who said we must align the interests of shareholders and management, and we must do this by paying people with more bonuses. Unfortunately, and here my experience is sadder that this is more common than one would like, the ignorance of financial economics when taught in finance courses is large. And anybody who was really aware of what happens to bonuses would have known that the value of a bonus depends on the volatility of the underlying reference point, in this case, largely profits, earnings per share, not the trend. So what this did was to increase the volatility of profits as published compared with the profits in the national accounts. And I will show you how dramatically, indeed, those have changed. What you've got is a change in the attitude of management towards short and long-term risks. Now, a lot of attention has been put on short-termism, but often because people say, the results are unfair, these people are gouging. What has been missing, I'm afraid, in this debate, is not just the unfairness of what's going on, but this really very bad impact this has on the economy that we're looking at. It's very bad news for us, not just in terms of fairness, but in terms of the way the economy runs. The long-term risks of companies are that you'll be competed out of existence. You'll find that other people have growing market share and other people have lower costs than you do. That, if you're after and worried about that, will determine you from keeping your prices very competitive and investing a lot of money to try and keep your production costs down. But the short-term risks to management today are having a fall in their EPS or their ROE or whatever index they use for peak payment. And this comes from lower margins and investment in equipment, which has a long-term benefit and a short-term detrimental effect on companies' profits. What people prefer to do today is to spend their money on buybacks rather than investment. Bonuses therefore encourage higher profit margins, low investment and volatile profits. Now to realize this, you have to recognize that in the short term, companies have great monopoly power. You can't suddenly turn away from everybody who's making the things that are currently available and say, I wish there was somebody else who was pricing things different I could buy from. In the short run, companies have great monopoly power, and so they can exercise this power for the short or the medium or the longer term in different ways. And at the moment, they have shifted their attention away from the medium to longer to the very short. And we can see this because what's happened to profit margins, investment, and volatility, the three things which are encouraged by option payments. Since 2001, sort of starting point really of this, profit margins have moved much less with the economy than they ever did before. And this is shown here. What I've done, I can't find output gap data going back a long way, but you've got capacity utilization. And if you do simple correlations, you will see that from 1949 to 2001, there was a marked relationship between log changes in non-financial profit margins and in manufacturing capacity utilization. The word there, margins, has been dropped and should exist. Apologies. But in the last decade, this has ceased to exist at all. It's not the only thing, obviously, influences people in investment. They are interested also in expectations which vary. But there was, in the past, a profound impact on profits and manufacturing capacity, and that has broken down. Profit margins are high as a result compared with output gaps. Here is a chart of the output gap as assumed by the OECD. I haven't invented it. As you can see, non-financial profit margins moved sideways during a period in which the output gap has actually grown. They've moved a bit together, but the trend is bad. Then we can go to the US. Here we have a more dramatic change. We've actually found the output gap going down and profit margins actually going up. Really quite an achievement, and an unusual one, something not seen before. And in the UK, we've also found that investment has fallen while profit margins are unchanged. People who doubt that the OECD gets output gap right are not going to be able to get away from this problem, because if the output gap's much bigger, that would explain perhaps why investment is lower, but you would expect even lower profit margins. So it doesn't much matter if you think the OECD is correct. You still see a very pronounced change in the behaviour of companies relative to the state of the economy. If we then turn to volatility, this is one of the more dramatic things. Two things happened in the last decade or more. One is the move from mark to cost to mark to market accounting, and the other is the change of the incentive to companies. The change incentive to companies has encouraged companies to produce volatile profits, because that maximizes the return on their option type contracts. The change from mark to cost to mark to market has just simply increased their ability to fake the figures. And the result of that can be demonstrated here. What I've done is to take the standard deviation of the profits after tax shown in the national income and product accounts in real terms and compare that with the EPS on the S&P 500 in the same terms. And I worked out the standard deviation over the previous 10 years. As you can see, from 1962 to 2002, the two tracked each other pretty much. And recently, however, in the last decade and a bit, the volatility of published profits has gone out to be 4.5 times that of the volatility of the profits in the national accounts. Okay, now, it's perhaps always interesting to see how the theory of those who actually look at these things would tie in with the data. Theoretical analysis has been extremely good at forecasting exactly the same thing, but it doesn't get a great deal of publicity. There is an admirable paper published by the New York Fed as a staff paper back in 2011 by John Donaldson, Natalia Gershon, and Mark Giannone. And it's called, very clearly, Some Unpleasant General Equilibrium Implications for Executive Incentive Compensation Contracts. What they basically say is that these type of remuneration contracts are what are known as convex contracts. They are ones in which you don't lose money if things go badly, but you make a huge amount of money if they go well. They are convex. Of course, if you turn the graph somewhere else, they're concave. But they're known as convex contracts. And they have huge short-term implications. And one of the ones they draw attention to is that the investment policies likely under these will drive the equilibrium level of equity to zero. Well, we're actually some way on the way to that. In recent years, both the US and the UK corporate sectors have been buying back stock at around 3% of GDP per annum. I may throw in, those people who try and persuade you that we're in the middle of a deleveraging recession are out of their tiny cotton-picking little minds and aren't looking at the data. Nobody buys back equity at vast rates if they're trying to deleverage. The two things are simply incompatible. The data and a lot of what you read in the financial press are incompatible. Managements prefer to buy back to investment. This is a chart of the proportion of corporate cash flow, that is to say, profits after tax plus depreciation, which is spent on different things. And the charts in order to put the two graphs on thing, I got different scales on both sides. On the left-hand side is the amount invested. But you can see from the graph that the amount of corporate cash flow currently being invested in America over the last 10 years is lower than it's ever been in the data set that we've got, which goes back to 1952. Whereas the amount distributed to shareholders, either through dividends or buybacks, has never been greater. The preference for looking after the short-term interests of management at the very considerable cost of the economy is abundantly clear from this data. Since I wrote the book, we've had, to my delight, additional evidence coming out. There has been a paper published called Corporate Investment and Stock Market Listing, a Puzzle, not to me a puzzle, what you'd expect. And this shows that the US economy now, which is, according to their data, roughly half quoted and half unquoted, the quoted sector is investing half the level of the unquoted section, and the profit margins of the unquoted are lower and pricing is more aggressive. We are quite clearly, I was giving this talk on these lines about 3 months ago, and somebody said to me from the audience, shouldn't you expect, if you're right, that unquoted companies would be investing now much more than quoted companies? And I said, yes, you would, and happily, since I wrote the book, data has come out in support of that. So this is rather nice for me. Robin Harding in the FT had an article on this about 2 months ago, and he's referred to it again in his article today, which also draws attention, I'm very pleased to see, to the need for people at last to take notice of the distortions to the economy which are coming through the management remuneration system. Another piece of evidence for the supposition that I'm putting forward is the way in which official forecasts seem so persistently wrong. Official forecasts we expect to be wrong, and that's not their fault. That's in the nature of the future being unknown and unknowable. But they've been particularly wrong in a particular direction. They have been surprised that inflation has been persistently higher than expected, than investment has been lower, than productivity has been worse. Each of these is exactly what you'd expect to happen as a result of the change in management incentives. Higher margins, after all, boost inflation. At the gross level, the rough division between capital and labour is 70% to labour, 30% to capital. So in output terms, if margins are high now, 6 percentage points higher than they were before, or an equilibrium level, which is very much what we've got, inflation is going to be roughly a third of that, higher than it otherwise would be. The perceived cost of capital to management has gone up because of the change in incentives. The cost to companies of investing has gone down. We have low interest rates, high stock market, low bond yields. The capital cost to companies has gone up, but people aren't investing. That is because the cost to management is huge, because if you invest or if you compete heavily, you damage your own short-term interests in terms of your remuneration. The result of that, of course, is productivity is poor. If you get a world in which it doesn't pay to invest and you get a bit of increased demand for your product, you will prefer to employ more labour and less capital. In technical terms, the coefficient of substitution has changed, i.e. the standard Cobb-Douglas production function, which says that the share of labour and management, say, labour and capital in output is constant over time with variations, it will be temporarily shifted up and people will prefer to employ labour. What we see, therefore, is interesting. Over the 20 years, 1992 to 2012, which I took as 20 years, not picking base dates, the UK, surprisingly to some, had the best productivity in terms of output, GDP, per hour worked. Closely followed by America, with Germany and Japan coming behind. Since then, the last 3 years, things have changed a bit. We've actually managed to have a falling productivity, quite an achievement, which even I don't expect we'll manage to maintain for all that long. America has got extremely poor productivity. Productivity in the last 3 years in America has been growing at about 0.5% per annum, a piece of data which is not often found in the newspapers. Japan and Germany have actually, in Japan's case, improved a bit. Japan has got one of the best productivity figures around in recent years, another figure that you wouldn't know if you read the newspapers. Japan's problem is different. They charge too much, they allow too much in the depreciation charge. The result of that is that they get too much past investment, and if you add to that the excessive depreciation allowances, you will now have too much depreciation actually being charged in current accounts, because the depreciation charged in current accounts is the product of the allowances plus the past level of investment. Japan invests more in its own country in business terms than any other GDP country, and with a declining population and an even more rapidly declining working population, that is downright foolish. A folly which is being encouraged by the present government. The latest Nikkei that I read on the way to give this talk says that Mr. Noda is very keen on trying to increase investment in Japan. I can think of few things which are more pointless and more futile and more ill-considered than that. The result is, in Japan, that the incremental capital output ratio, the amount of extra output you give for any unit of new investment, is the worst of any G5 country. Here we are. You can see the low business ICOR in the middle, in the green thing. In spite of the peculiarities of the system, my green columns have appeared red in the index bar. Many apologies. But the growth figure is purple, and that's correct. Japan has grown slower than anybody else, and it's invested more. This is, frankly speaking, a waste of money. It's a waste of decency for living individuals. If people had actually spent more on consumption and invested less, their future incomes would probably have not been hit one jot or tittle, and their current incomes would have gone up. They would have been better off. Why does this happen? Japanese companies can invest at the moment more than the rest of the world in GDP, more than most of other developed countries as a proportion of GDP, without actually spending any more than their depreciation allowance. This means that they are bound to run a saving surplus if they don't pay out 100% of their profits in dividends. And I can assure you that there are lots of people like bankers and others and conservative boards of directors who don't really approve of paying out 100% of profits all the time. The result is that Japan is, as a structural system, bound to have a large current account surplus on the business sector. The reason that this happens is, of course, not because they're really earning huge amounts of money. The reason is that they are seriously understating their profits. You can look at that by just comparing US and Japanese accounts. I took it this, it says here that Japanese quoted non-financial depreciation is 1.9 times profits and US is 0.6. That is a figure actually which is the year to March 2011, which is a suitable date to date because at that moment the profit share of output was identical for non-financials in both countries. So it's a perfectly fair comparison. Which is, one can be pretty sure that US companies seriously overstate their profits, but we can also be pretty sure that Japanese companies seriously understate theirs. How would depreciation changing help? Well, what Japan needs is a switch from investment to consumption. And you can't do that by getting Japanese to spend more of their incomes because they spend roughly 100% of it already. One of the big myths around is that Japanese individuals are huge savers. They're not. The savings rate in Japan is the lowest of any G5 country at the household level. What you need, therefore, to get is an increase in consumer incomes. You can get that either by wages having a higher proportion of output or by having more dividends. The problem with getting wages up is that, other things being equal, profits go down. And anybody who's lived, as I have, and spent a lot of my life in Japan, knows that there is a thing called the shunto every spring. It happens round about the 1st of April. Nearly everything in Japan happens on April Fool's Day. It's one of the big issues that you notice when you go there. And what is the shunto is determined by what happens to profits the year before. If profits are bad, wages don't go up. In fact, companies are cutting back. So it's very, you've got to break the logjam. You've got to find a way in which you can get profits up and the labour share up. Well, the only way you can do that is get the depreciation charge down. That's the wedge that you have to remove. And there's bonuses as well, which are also paid in July and shogatsu in January each year. Lower depreciation would increase investment, lower investment, increase consumer incomes, both through wages and through dividends. Coming back, therefore, to the final thing, academics are using economic models which don't work. This applied both to the entry into the financial crisis and the moment to getting out of the current errors. A key error was in using a model without a financial sector. Another today is ignoring the change in incentives. This is very dangerous. One of the other things you can read in the, for example, in this week's Economist, said, oh, debt levels have come down a lot. They haven't. And QE is busy driving things up to bubble levels. While well short of the peaks of 29 and 2000, valuations are at the other previous peaks that we've seen. Here is a chart of debt, private and public, against GDP. It's come down a little, but as you can see, it is way above the levels that were a cause of problems back in 1929. Here's a valuation of the stock market. The stock market is capable of being valued, and you can value it in two ways, and they give you the same answer. And if those of you wish to hear more of this, you can either buy the two books on the subject, which I've previously written, one with Stephen Wright, or you can come to a course which I give with Stephen about four or five times a year through a Didasco thing, and I'm happy for anybody to sign up on that, and so will the organizer. Okay, debt and asset prices need to come down, but they must come down slowly. Rapid falls in asset prices precipitate crises. Fiscal deficits must be shrunk, but you can only do that if you attack the fundamental problems. You can't cut a fiscal deficit unless you cut the offsets. As a matter of identity, a fiscal surplus must be equal to the saving surpluses of the other three sectors, the foreign sector, the corporate sector, and the household sector. That is a necessity. It's an identity. We must do this before people try to get escape velocity, because if we get escape velocity with current situation, in which companies have aggressive pricing, we will find that inflationary expectations pick up well before other people think that there's the end of the output gap. One of the great lessons of the 70s was you can have stagflation. You can have inflation with output gaps. But that was therefore ascribed at the time, I think correctly, to change inflationary expectations. But it isn't the only reason you can do it. You can also have it if you have a change in the behavior patterns of companies. And that could be added to change in inflationary expectations to cause a very unpleasant situation. I should say, in finalizing, when I wrote the book, I attacked what I call the theology of economics. And I said that economics today was very like the scholasticism of 12th century theology. Basically, it has the same virtues: intellectual rigor, well-considered discussions and thought, and the same defect: it's completely unscientific. Theology doesn't mind terribly about that because revelation happens. But I do not think we should rely on the revelations that appear to occur to central bankers, which cannot be supported by evidence. And the vast majority of serious problems that people throw up at the moment in economics have that quality. They are untestable or not robust under testing. People are valuing the models for their elegance, not for their relevance. And we need to change that. I quoted David Deutsch and Arthur Eckert, two well-known physicists, who say the same problem exists today in physics. I then sent my book to a number of people, philosopher, historian, who wrote back and say, same problem. I fear that a tendency towards scholasticism has become a deep problem for academia in perhaps nearly every subject, but it seems to me particularly acute and dangerous in economics. Thank you.